I'm Jeremy Loeb with WCQS News. You're about to hear an interview with Representative Chuck McGrady, a Republican of Henderson County. He's expected to be one of the most influential legislators from Western North Carolina during this long session of the General Assembly. Chuck McGrady, thanks for coming back in. It's always nice to have you.
Glad to be here.
Well, let's jump right in and start with the special sessions. You had posted this lengthy explanation about what had taken place during the special session. The first one, you know, concerning some of the relief for the wildfires out here in the West, and then also what happened additional to that.
That's right. Just
sort of broadly speaking, what was your takeaway from what occurred?
Well, we started out really good with the disaster relief, both for the West and the East. There'll be more of that in the upcoming session, mostly related to flooding in the East. And that was all done rather unanimously. The next special session had to do with mostly the governor's powers and structure of government. That was done on a very partisan basis. And then the third special session was an effort to reconsider House Bill 2. Ultimately, that effort failed, but I'm pretty sure it's an issue that will come up very early in the upcoming long session.
Yeah. So talking about some of the changes, you noted that you liked some of the parts of the bills. You didn't like some of the parts of the bills. Let's talk about SB 4 and some of the things that you were in favor of, some of the things you had some concerns about. I think Senate Bill 4 had to do with the election changes, merging the state ethics board.
Yeah. My experience as a candidate and as a public official and as an advocate is that the election law and process has all been divided among a bunch of different state departments. And so it's very hard to comply as a candidate. It's very hard if you're an advocate to try to figure out who's who and where the money is going. And so the effort there to combine different functions, state ethics, the Board of Elections, and the Secretary of State's functions, I think is a really good thing on policy. These issues tend to divide along partisan lines, and in the past, Board of Elections, not just the state board, but all the local boards, follow the governor, and so they divide up 3-2, 3-2, 4-3, whatever the, and a effort here was made to make the partisan split as between Democrats and Republicans exactly the same in terms of their votes, and then require a supermajority for those boards to take action. In theory, that's great. It will lead to bipartisan decisions. My concern with it was that it, I'm not sure it won't lead to
some sort of gridlock.
Gridlock, yeah, is a good way of putting it, where nothing happens because they're not able to come to a conclusion. So I characterized that whole session is sort of the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah.
And there was some amount of good in it. There was some amount of bad in it. And a lot of it was very ugly. We might have been doing good things, but for the wrong reasons.
Concerning the elections bills, there seemed to be some ways that Republicans gained power that weren't immediately noticeable. For instance, like having the chairman of the elections board be a Republican in even-numbered years, which would be during major elections. And I think that, you know, concerning whenever there's gridlock, it would seem to revert back to whatever was previously. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, and I'm sort of speaking from memory, there was something that I read about concerning early voting hours, that if county was trying to offer more early voting hours, if there was a split decision and nobody could agree, it would go back to the fewest number of hours in voting sites. Is that correct?
Now you've got me. I'd have to go back. I've tried to put the special session behind me and not to
yeah.
think about it.
I see.
I will say it varies from county to county. And early voting is wildly popular in Henderson County. I mean, a majority of the people vote early, and the voting percentages have gone up. There's no interest in my county in doing anything that cuts back on early voting. And I guess I don't view what was done in December as, you know, in any critical way, turning back the clock with respect to the ability to vote early.
I see. Okay. Yeah, and you talked about just how bad the optics were.
It was. The optics were awful. For example, go into a different bill, but if we really thought that we needed to provide more power to the superintendent of public instruction, basically return it to where it was back in the 1990s, it would have been better to do that outside of the election cycle.
Yeah.
But I do understand why a decision was made to move forward with that, because, again, if you're going to make those changes, making them as you're changing office holders makes some amount of sense. And I think I know the Board of Education has filed a lawsuit, and my hope is that we'll resolve that issue as between the Board of Elections and legislative leaders, and perhaps can reflect that in legislation that will be offered in the upcoming long session.
So, you know, if you had issues with how this looked, you know, and, you know, the fact that you guys went there to deal with disaster relief and all of a sudden there was this surprise, you know, there were already protesters there. They were there to protest what they thought could be a court packing maneuver. But people knew something was up. You know, people were there. Why does this keep happening? I mean, why does this sort of political maneuvering take place? And why does it happen basically when there's so much opposition to it? I mean, does the leadership in the House and Senate not even care? Because it seems like this is one of those things that gets people so upset. And when you take the totality of all these bills, you've had issues with some parts of them. And it seems like each part of that bill could have been discussed and may have had some agreement reached on it. But taking the totality of it, it did look like this big power grab.
Well, things happen when you don't move on bills at points in time where you don't have the votes to move on them. And I have said to people, we sometimes do the right thing for the wrong reasons. And I think that probably is, I'm not so naive as to think that some of the changes we were putting in place were not motivated by, you know, the politics.
Right.
And if we had tried to do the same thing at a different point in time, the votes wouldn't have been there to do that. And so I think that's what it is a function of. And the third special session had to do with House Bill 2. And actually, that special session, we tried to get it ready to run earlier. What is missing in politics these days is trust between the people, the decision makers. It's really hard to get consensus and move forward on whatever the set of issues are when your leadership does not have relationships with each other, positive relationships with each other,
yeah,
that allow them to discuss differences of opinion.
You've got the special session on House Bill 2. When that broke down, leadership blamed Roy Cooper. They blamed the Charlotte City Council for not fully repealing.
And when I say leadership, I include Cooper there.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, what happened there is the agreement was that Charlotte would repeal its ordinance in toto, and in return, the General Assembly would move to repeal House Bill 2 in toto. The problem occurred when the city of Charlotte, whether accidentally or not, didn't repeal its entire ordinance in the first effort. And the feeling was that, wait a second, we caught them doing something other than what they said they were going to do. And at that point, everything began to go south. And there wasn't a relationship between incoming Governor Cooper and Pro Tem Berger and Speaker Moore such that they could get over what may have just been a miscommunication. It felt like if you were a legislative leader or even a legislator that, yeah, you know, now they're coming back to repeal, but it's only after we caught them once again trying to do something that we view as illegal.
Uh-huh.
And it just, it messed up the deal.
I have a question about that. Why, you know, I haven't heard anyone ask this. Why was Charlotte expected to repeal all of these other things that had nothing to do with bathrooms?
They were expected to, they put in place an ordinance that the General Assembly views is clearly unconstitutional. And the idea was to reset completely. Mm. It appeared that they had repealed a portion of their ordinance, but they didn't repeal a portion of their ordinance that might have allowed them to try to, via contract, impose their standards on other parts of the state. And see, again, the legislature probably doesn't have any problem with Charlotte enacting laws that only apply to their employees or only apply to their footprint. But if Charlotte is trying to pass an ordinance where they're going to use their contractual powers to require employers in other parts of the state to follow Charlotte's view on discrimination or bathrooms, that is not acceptable. Now, if Cooper and Speaker Moore and President Pro Tem Berger, you know, had a trusting relationship, perhaps they could have gotten over that. But they don't have a great relationship right now.
Right.
You build a relationship over time by working together on things and building a level of trust. And certainly the governor-elect had no reason to trust the legislative leaders given the earlier special session. And the speaker and the pro tem had no reason to trust the incoming governor. Most recently reflected on in terms of his unilateral effort to expand Medicaid, which flies in the face of very clear law that says the governor can't do what he's doing here.
Mm-hmm.
So to move forward on reconsideration of House Bill 2, it's going to take some building of relationships between the primary players. I'm hopeful.
How does it work as far as the power structure? Because here in the West, especially with the resignation of Tom Apodaca, we think of you as the senior most member and probably the most powerful lawmaker out here in Western North Carolina. And you had issues with this. So who's making the decisions to go into the special session and say, we're going to introduce now these bills, and these are the ones that are going to introduce? And I know you had worked on this regulatory reform bill. It seemed pretty clear it was something that you had worked pretty hard on and gotten a number of issues that you wanted taken care of in that bill. And that did not come up. No one considered it during special session.
Well, you've asked a compound question.
Sure,
here, so
yeah,
let
sorry.
Me, let
yeah.
me try to deconstruct it a bit.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, the leaders, the speaker, the majority leader in the House, the pro tem and the majority leader and the rules chairs, you know, they sort of set the agenda for the General Assembly. House and Senate leadership came together to decide we were going to have a special session, the second set, and that's a function of their leadership positions. Now, my position on House Bill 2 probably hasn't been real clear until recently. I've spent the last 6, 7, 8 months working to try to figure out how to get us to a different position or get us back to where we once were on this. My leadership, meaning Speaker Moore, knew what I was about and was quite willing to allow me to continue to do what I do, and that is try to get a majority of the House behind some approach to that issue. And so I feel, you know, empowered by the leadership. When you're a budget chair, you're fairly senior and you've got lots of responsibilities. And so, I was able to play a positive role in terms of trying to bring together the parties. I was disappointed with the result, but that doesn't mean that effort is over.
Right.
We have lost with Tom Apodaca's retirement. You know, he was probably the second most powerful state senator and could literally set the agenda of the state Senate through his rules committee position. We're not going to be able to fill that position anytime soon, but the closest thing we've got in the West probably is a chair of an appropriations committee. Ultimately, what government does is allocate limited resources to whatever the needs are in the state, meaning allocate money. And so, you know, the budget is the one thing that we do that, you know, we have to do and is critically important. And to the extent that I can play a role for both my district but Western North Carolina, that's probably good for all of us.
But in terms of the special sessions, that wasn't a kind of thing where a number of lawmakers couldn't say, you know, this is not a good thing we're doing. I mean, look at the protesters we have outside already. I mean, at what point does the leadership, are they just going full steam ahead, or do they have the backing of their constituents? I mean, I'm not in those caucus meetings.
They obviously have the backing of their constituents because a majority of the House and the Senate passed legislation. And yes, but there were protesters, but if we responded to every set of protests that some group of people got excited about, you would have sort of the tail wagging the dog. People that are, you know, most active and most loud win.
I'm not sure if they had support for doing legislation in this particular manner without really
informing anyone. Legislators had just been reelected by very large majorities. So it wasn't like my colleagues felt like they didn't have the support back in their district.
The state had just elected Roy Cooper as well.
Barely. The House and the Senate, was one extra Republican senator and there's one less Republican House member. And Donald Trump took the state. Cooper, you know, wasn't a, you know, an overwhelming choice.
Sure.
Got less than 50% of the votes. And that's not what happened with respect to the legislative branch.
I mean, doesn't that speak more to the problems that the state had maybe with the previous governor, that the fact that Donald Trump won the state fairly easily by about 5 percentage points, and also Senator Burr was reelected pretty overwhelmingly as well. And then to go in and sort of strip the power from the governor that had sort of defied those odds.
I get the argument. I understand the optics. I wish we had taken up some of the things we took up at a different point in time. There were other things that occurred, though. I mean, we have the McCrory versus Berger lawsuit, which represents a somewhat fundamental shift in power, more authority being given or clarified with respect to the governor. And so the powers, for example, over education and the appointments to the university system and the confirmation process for cabinet officials actually are written into our Constitution. Mm-hmm. They've just been things that up to this point, the General Assembly didn't feel like it needed to assert its power. It now does. Uh-huh. I wish we had put in confirmation back when we were dealing with a Republican Governor McCrory. Uh-huh. The optics then would have been perfectly fine, and I suspect a lot of people wouldn't have been down worrying about some major shift in authority. But, you know, it's part of the North Carolina Constitution, and I just don't have a real problem with the General Assembly, given the election, asserting the power that it actually has been given under the Constitution.
You did have an issue, it sounded like, with the reduction of appointments to Governor Cooper down to 425 from 1,500. And what I thought was interesting in your assessment, you had said that, you know, had an amendment been offered to raise the number, you probably would have supported it. My question is, was that sort of something that you came to afterwards, and why couldn't you have offered that amendment if you felt that way?
I could have offered the amendment, but the thing had gotten pretty partisan at that point. You got to remember, I mean, your bandwidth is only so large. I was certainly going to vote on what was there on the floor there, but those were not bills that I was handling. They didn't come through committees that I was on.
Yeah.
And unbeknownst to my constituents and the public, I was actually working on the House Bill 2 session that was soon to come up. And so, you know, you just don't have the bandwidth to be out there putting forward amendments. Now, with respect to the underlying subject, for decades, the political appointment power of the governor was set at about 300 employees, I believe. Mm-hmm. Then back in 2013, I guess, we moved that up significantly to like 1,500 employees. My understanding is Governor McCrory never actually appointed anything approaching that, but it was more, it was over 1,000 and probably 1,200 employees were political appointees. There was probably no basis for going to 1,500 versus 300. Uh-huh. And I don't know really what the right number is. I'm glad that we actually ended up at a higher number than governors prior to McCrory ended up with. And so the number now is 450. And I just didn't feel comfortable because there didn't seem to be any empirical basis for any of these numbers. If we're going to set the number, then it would have been nice to have, you know, a committee look at it and figure out all the political appointees that ought to be part of a new administration and make sure we were in the ballpark. Do I think 450 is better than three? Yes. Do I like the optics of we're doing this just as the administration is trying to put its administration together? No, I didn't.
Speaking of stretching your bandwidth, I think I did that with my 10-part question that I asked you earlier. But your regulatory reform bill, were you disappointed that that didn't get a hearing during special session?
I'm not.
No? Okay.
The regulatory reform bill that I introduced was the bill that we were working on when the Senate suddenly went home during the summer. It actually has some provisions I don't support.
I see.
But we had negotiated those provisions out, and I was willing to be supportive of a bill where the negotiations had gotten to the point that they did. The original Senate bills there had significant changes on electronic recycling. It had provisions that I actually supported with respect to craft brewing and beer. And it had provisions that would have made it much more difficult to locate wind farms. And I introduced the legislation without those three provisions because those were the three provisions that we were still in negotiations on at the point in time the Senate, you know, took its marbles and went home. The Senate, for whatever reason, decided not to take it up, and so that's fine if they want to start through negotiations again. That bill is now dead, and we'll start over.
But you have a framework, I guess, to work from.
Well, I assume that since we, a large portion, probably 90% of the reg reform bill that I introduced in December is totally non-controversial. The reg reform bill that passed the House passed nearly unanimously. So there are regulatory reform provisions that a vast majority on a bipartisan basis support of all types.
I'm sorry if I'm not understanding you correctly. Are you saying that the reform bill itself, you still have some issues with that bill and you're hoping that it really doesn't go through? Or are you?
I was willing to abide by
the understanding
we had at the end of the session, and therefore I introduced a bill that reflected that agreement. That doesn't mean that I agree with all the provisions in that bill. And if now that we're starting over, I will oppose some of those provisions. Typically, the regulatory reform bills have largely focused on environmental regulations. And given my background, I have often been on the opposite side of regulatory reform bills put forward by the majority of my Republican House caucus. Because of my expertise in the area, though, both then Speaker Tillis and now Speaker Moore have consistently put me on conference committees and put me in a position to critique the bills that have come forward. I have supported a few of them, probably opposed more than I've supported, because I just oftentimes feel that the effort to reform the regulations, while well-intended, don't adequately protect the public interest.
I'm asking you to speculate a bit on this and jumping around a bit, but in talking about the provision in one of the bills that was passed to require Senate confirmation for Cooper's appointees, that seems like that would be one of those things that would be perfectly fine. But when you have this level of distrust between the governor and lawmakers, I'm asking for your sort of prediction, but do you think that Cooper would be able to get his guys through, or could there be such animosity between the two parties that they might just not allow his nominees to go forward.
I think Cooper will get all or most of his nominees through after the Senate takes up those nominations. He's got in place interim people in each of those departments, and it's just going to take time. It's been a little disconcerting for me in that the sort of the right wing, mostly the think tanks, you know, have particularly gone at his appointment over at the Department of Environmental Quality, Michael Reagan. But I'm, you know, publicly on record as saying, you know, Michael, I don't see what the problem is here. I think it's a lack of understanding of sort of the environmental community and some view that, you know, Michael Reagan is some sort of environmental radical. And I find that amusing, but I don't have a vote on that. I'm in the House and not the Senate. And so I think a number of his appointments, for example, his appointment over at Department of Transportation, you know, he's appointed a well-respected, professional, longtime employee in the transportation department to the secretary position. Do I think that nomination is going to be held up? No. And again, the model here, it's in our Constitution. And what's happening in Washington right now? You're going through confirmation process. That's the way it is oftentimes done, and the practice we put in place in the special session mirrors federal practice and is, in my opinion, completely consistent with North Carolina law.
Do you think that among some of your colleagues that there was anybody that could be appointed to DEQ that wouldn't be seen as an environmental radical if their philosophy is more along the lines of protecting the environment and not supporting the business community?
I really can't speculate on that.
And jumping back again to the first point of business that you guys took up in the special session in terms of supporting the affected communities of the hurricane and the wildfires, it was mentioned that those were first steps.
Yes.
What do you think more needs to be done?
Well, we don't have any of the agricultural losses that occurred in the East. Talking to Commissioner Troxler, it just takes time, and they were more focused on salvaging crops than they were in figuring out the damages that had occurred.
Yeah.
The other thing is we don't want to supplant federal grant monies coming in. And the week we were moving to take up the disaster relief bill, Congress was actually acting. And so we need to figure out what monies are going to be pulled down from the federal disaster relief. And then to the extent that we add state monies, those state monies need to sort of fill the gaps that are left. I think most of the cost related to the West has probably been covered in this first bill.
I see. Okay.
But clearly not all the cost related to the East are covered in the bill. And if you look back at Hurricane Floyd, for example, it takes 3 or 4 months to sort of sort all the cost out and where the money is needed, whether in terms of infrastructure replacement, capital needs. There'll probably be some impact in even our upcoming budget in terms of we've learned that we need more rescue helicopters, for example, in the East. Well, that takes money, and you probably see in the budget we adopt this year at least some effort to address some issues that we perhaps weren't aware of until we got into having to deal with these two disasters.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Asheville water a bit. That court ruling that was in favor of the city of Asheville concerning Asheville's water, you had mentioned before coming here, you were in talks with Asheville Mayor Esther Mannheimer, and so you're talking to community leaders about a way forward. What would you like to see, and how have those talks been going?
Well, I'm firmly committed to managing water and sewer on a regional basis. And the fact is, I mean, you can read the lawsuits. City of Asheville, over time, has used its water infrastructure, one, to run city government, and two, as a weapon against its neighbors. I don't think that should happen. Mm-hmm. The sewer authority here functions very well, and I very much would like to see water and sewer managed in a regional basis. Now, the Supreme Court did what it did. It reversed a unanimous decision of the Court of Appeals. So there's obviously some legal basis on both sides of this argument. Yeah, I've been very upfront to say there were several ways to get to where we could get in terms of a regional water and sewer authority. We chose one way that now hasn't worked, and I'm going to look back at the other ways to do the same thing. With that said, not threatening. Another way to get to the right place would be for the local governments involved to actually talk with each other and address the serious concerns that they have. So I've started that process. I met with Laurel Park. I've met with Henderson County. I got with Mayor Manheimer this morning. Mm-hmm. I will get with Mayor Volk and her city manager from Hendersonville tomorrow. I'm intending to reach out to Buncombe County and a number of these local governments and see, rather than taking a legislative approach to this issue, whether the governments themselves can make sure that water particularly is a regional resource, and we all benefit from the supply of waters and the quality of water that we have in the area, and that, it makes financial sense, and no government, local government, is in a position to pressure other local governments by their power over water or sewer infrastructure. So we'll see. There's a number of ideas been put forward already, and I'm going to try to facilitate a process before I look to, another legislative way of getting to the same position as the earlier law did.
Does it look to you like the local leaders are making a good faith effort to help you facilitate that?
They've all been quite open to talking and meeting, and I urged Henderson County, for example, to reach out to the city of Asheville. And today, the mayor, Manheimer, certainly was going to go back and look at some ideas, see if it makes sense from the city of Asheville's perspective, and be prepared to engage with Henderson County or Hendersonville or Laurel Park or Black Mountain, mm-hmm. whatever group of local governments want to engage here.
The other question I have is, when you mentioned that Asheville has used this as a weapon against its neighbors, I'm wondering, because I don't really know the history and the background as well, is that something where the actors are the same now, or was that in the past? And specifically speaking about the current leadership, is that the same thing that's going on?
I have no problem with the way Asheville is running its water system now.
I see, okay.
But as recently as 2003... Okay. Buncombe County and Asheville were at serious odds, and the Buncombe County delegation, Republicans and majority Democrats, put in place the so-called Sullivan Acts, which restricted Asheville's authority in terms of how it set its rates. The Asheville water system is not just Asheville's water system. It's actually a water system that was a combination of Asheville infrastructure and Buncombe County infrastructure. The lawsuits here go back into the 1930s.
Oh, wow.
There's a lot of history. Yeah. None of the players, obviously back then, were
right.
the same players. Very few of the players, even as recently as the 2003 blow-up, are the same players. Henderson County, for example, joined the earlier water authority, gave up its water assets to the city of Asheville, and then in less than 10 years, that authority went away.
I see, yeah.
And so, some would argue that maybe Henderson County struck a bad deal. Others would argue that no, there's been a failure of consideration here. The county wouldn't have given up its water assets to the city of Asheville if it had any clue that the city of Asheville was going to abolish the water authority within a short period of time.
I see. So, is this economic or is this political or is it both? I mean, is it a case of Republican versus Democrat in some cases? Or is it
no,
just...
it's not really Republican versus Democrat. It is different jurisdictions' views as to
resources.
How these things ought to be managed. it happens. I mean, Henderson County happens to be Republican. Hendersonville, not so much, but it's really not a, you know, a Republican Democratic thing at the local level.
I see. Okay, interesting. Well, getting away from some of those issues, just going forward, what are some of your priorities? Obviously, this is a budget year, so I know that will be a big key for you. But what are some other things?
Yeah, I'm a budget chair, so I mean, the budget will be a lot of the work I do. I have introduced over the last 6 years a constitutional amendment related to eminent domain, what power governments have to condemn private property. I'd like to see that passed. We got close last time. The Chief Justice has asked me to take the lead on something called Raise the Age, which North Carolina is only one of two states that treat 16 and 17-year-olds as adults in the criminal justice system. And I think science, brain science, has proved that a 16-year-old, while he physically may look like an adult, doesn't have the judgment necessary to be handled within the adult system in all cases. And so that's something that I intend to take up. The big issues there is if you remove 16 and 17-year-olds out of the justice system, adult justice system, we don't have capacity for them in the juvenile system. Mm-hmm. And so we got to spend some money if we're going to go down that road. I'm real excited. I've just been appointed chair of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Committee.
That's very appropriate.
And I've thoroughly enjoyed the accidental leadership role. I've ended up on all things craft brewing, cider, even distilleries.
And yeah, let me just be clear when I said that I'm referring to where you are located.
Well, I know that.
It's
actually a source of pride in Western North Carolina, Asheville, Hendersonville, and other places. Every one of these places has a new craft brewer, oftentimes in town on Main Street. And, you know, if you go back 10 or 15 years, you sort of go, it couldn't happen here.
Yeah.
But our laws haven't kept up with it, and I very much want to get there. More recently, we've had an issue related to a budget provision that has huge financial implications for school districts around the class size issue. And in the special session, the House passed, actually, a revision to that. Senate didn't take it up. I'll be introducing that bill again on probably the first day of the General Assembly session. And I, in the past, have been one of the lead sponsors of the nonpartisan redistricting bill, and I again expect that I will take the lead on that. I don't have high hopes for that right now, but, you know, do I think that is likely to be passed at some point in the future? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm willing to try to work on it even in the coming year.
Okay, great. Well, you know, you mentioned the Raise the Age. That seems like that could be a bipartisan push. I was speaking with Terry Van Dyne, and she had brought that up as something that you were pushing as well, and she said that she was on board with that. So it seems like that could be a Democrat and Republican issue alike. I was also talking to some of your new colleagues, Representatives Cody Henson and Mike Clampett. They had mentioned your leadership and talked. I asked them, you know, had you been offering advice to them? And, you know, as you were taking this more senior role in the legislature, what is some of the advice that you're doling out to these new guys?
Well, I mean, I talked to Representative Henson last night, actually, about the class size issue. He's meeting with his school superintendent in Transylvania and in Henderson County, I believe today, and told them what I was proposing, and you know, he intends to be a co-sponsor of the legislation. My former legislative assistant is now the legislative assistant for Mike Clampett.
Yep.
So, you know, again, I've got easy entree. Freshman legislators, you know, anytime you start a new job, you're a freshman, and you, no matter how well skilled you are, you got to learn the people and sort of learn how to move things forward. And I was really lucky in that I had some real strong mentors, both in the House and in my senator, that allowed me to become a very effective legislator in a relatively short period of time. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to try, to the extent I can, to be helpful to junior members in the House regardless of whether they're Republicans or Democrats. But I obviously have more regular contact with Republican members than I do the Democratic members.
Yeah, Cody Hinson had said that your advice to him, probably the biggest piece of advice, was sort of just keep your head down and focus. It seems like you focus a lot on the policy end of things. And I notice, you know, on Twitter, you engage with your constituents fairly often if you can. And I'm wondering how you do that, since, you know, you're engaging with people. Obviously, the noise is swirling all the time. How do you handle that yourself?
Well, that's part of the hardest part of my job, is trying to sort of engage. The special session was the perfect example. I mean, I probably got 3,000 or 4,000 messages in a short period of time. Very few of them came from my district. And so, you know, just trying to wade through the chaff, not that I don't represent Durham, or I don't represent Charlotte, or,
sure.
or you know, some small town elsewhere. My focus is on my district and broadly Western North Carolina. The mountain region is what I'm about. And so, you know, I just spend a lot of time doing it. You've got to communicate with people in the way that they communicate with you. And I would prefer not to be on Twitter. I hate it. But
I'm with you on that.
But some percentage of my constituents, that's where they communicate. As long as they're civil, I will respond to them. Mm-hmm. If they start throwing around a lot of adjectives and adverbs, you know, I'll ignore them initially, and if it gets abusive, I'll just block them. But I'm up on Facebook. I've got my own webpage. I've got a webpage at the General Assembly. I put out a newsletter on a regular basis. I engage with people on Twitter. I try to use all the tools that are available to me to communicate with my constituents. What's been interesting is that my readership, particularly on my blog newsletter, I guess as I've gotten senior in the House, I probably get more coverage on that among Raleigh-based lobbyists and other offices.
Right.
And it's a real challenge because, you know, I want on the one hand to be transparent and try to, I use that as a way of teaching people or explaining what are really difficult topics.
Yeah.
But at the same time, to be effective, I can't be about calling out my colleagues for things that they might do that I view as stupid. I mean, it just doesn't foster a good relationship. And so, you know, I've got to say enough that people can understand what my position is and what the public policy ramifications of whatever the issue are, without going so far as to pointing fingers.
Right, right. Are you optimistic here for the state of North Carolina in terms of what we're heading into? And then broadening that nationally, you know, with your environmental background, there's a lot of apprehension about the Trump administration. And I wonder how you feel right now, just personally looking at things.
I mean, it's everything for me is pretty disquieting. I came to this job as an environmental leader. I have not been hesitant to be critical of the then McCrory administration on large blocks of environmental policy. And I've got similar reservations about what I see coming out of the Trump administration. So to the extent that, you know, environmental issues are important to me, yes, I'm uncomfortable. But it is what it is, and I'm not going to speculate. Trump seems to say contradictory things on a regular basis, and so I don't have any real understanding, any real insider view of, you know, what actually will come about. Mm-hmm. And the president has a lot of powers, but there's also Congress. While my party is in charge of both chambers, you know, it's pretty close there in the Senate, and I can't speculate on mm-hmm. things that I'm not currently involved in.
Right.
I do hope that, you know, the Cooper administration is successful in whatever that means. I'm sure I'll agree with the Cooper administration on a range of things, probably more likely to support them on, for example, environmental policy than I was to support the Macquarie administration. But there may be some other things that I, you know, just can't get at. And it's disconcerting to me that, you know, the Cooper administration has chosen its first battle to be Medicaid expansion.
Right.
Assuming I could even agree substantively, I think, you know, it just, it's very in your face. And I, you know, I get it. He could argue that, well, the General Assembly was very in my face back in December.
Yeah.
But we keep saying that two wrongs make a right.
Right.
If you're going to build a relationship, do you start down this road first? Mm. I would suggest not, but I'm not governor.
Are you hopeful, though, that the two sides could get together in a room and talk things out? It seems like HB2, there's already been talks going on, even post-special session.
After we got over the
the
public temper tantrums, you know, discussions are ongoing. And so, yes, I'm hopeful anytime we can get policymakers to begin to build relationships with each other and understand each other's views and be willing to go in an incremental fashion to whatever solution whoever is pushing the issue is wanting to go.
Yeah.
Too often I think it's either this or nothing. And, you know, what happened to compromise? What happened to incrementally changing public opinion over some period of time, over some period of years?
All right. Well, Representative McGrady, those are my questions. Anything else you wanted to discuss?
Nothing I ever want to discuss.
Yeah. All right. Well, I always appreciate it. And thank you so much for being willing to come in.
Glad to be here.